dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Congress recently broke its pattern of rubber-stamping legislation desired by the administration by passing a bill that included a prohibition against the implementation of the Total Information Awareness Program, TIA. TIA is a brainchild of John Poindexter, who was implicated in the Iran-Contra scandal during the Reagan-Bush presidency in the mid-1980s, and is a project designed to compile dossiers on every person living in the United States in the name of terrorism prevention. This surveillance and monitoring program was met with widespread opposition by people across the political spectrum, who felt this invasion of privacy could not be justified in the name of fighting terrorism, and that it was more likely to be used to target political opponents. Though TIA seems to many like a quantum leap in the level of surveillance in society, in fact, most people already have dossiers on their activities that have been compiled as the result of their everyday transactions. Every time we access a bank account, use a credit card, browse the internet, or talk on a cell phone, a record of those actions is created somewhere. We have been drifting down the path of increasing surveillance for a long time as the byproduct of the information age. Objections to the TIA have often been framed in terms of the invasion of privacy of law-abiding citizens. While supporters of such measures claim that these will enhance safety from terrorist attacks and that law-abiding citizens have nothing to fear and will, in fact, benefit. A perspective that gets little press is a scrutiny of the whole concept of the questionable virtue of abiding laws. Our social mythology is that lawmakers of our choosing make laws that most of us support and benefit from. And by following those laws, we demonstrate ourselves to be good and productive members of society. However, the real situation is that the people who make our laws are mostly beholden to those who occupy the desirable positions at the top of society, and that these laws often benefit that class of people at the expense of the rest of us or some identifiable segment of us. From the standpoint of a variety of people in society, defying laws in order to change them has been the only path to justice and equity. When enough people refuse to obey a law, when they openly flout their disobedience, laws change. But this manner of changing society starts with a few people whose actions inspire others until a mass movement arises. These dissenters, many of them now respected national figures such as Dr. Martin Luther King, start out as lawbreakers. If the state is able to apprehend them before they can spread their message, those in control can maintain a status quo to their liking with much greater ease. Thus, our real level of meaningful freedom is the ability to challenge rather than abide laws. Tonight we're going to hear excerpts from City State, a critical forum on surveillance and social control that took place in Melbourne and Sydney, Australia last year. What is remarkable about this material is not only the approaches the speakers you will hear take to the subject, but also the extent to which the situation in Australia is identical to ours, down to anti-terrorism legislation containing provisions for secret detentions, and definitions of terrorism that seem to encompass political protest within them. Canada is another country that passed legislation so similar to that passed here in the wake of September 11th that it could have been authored by the same people who created the USA Patriot Act. Alternative Radio Australia produced the material from which tonight's program has been excerpted.
Held in Sydney and Melbourne 2002, City State is the result of a collaboration between the Surveillance Unit, UTS Community Law and Legal Research Centre, and Space Station Media Lab, who decided to create a project to increase public debate about surveillance and social control in our society. City State featured a range of interested people, academics, activists and artists, who create critical paths of understanding and response to surveillance technologies. We begin this presentation by acknowledging the widespread tightening of surveillance in the aftermath of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Whilst their ability to curb terrorism is questionable, these new developments in surveillance erode the civil rights of citizens, who will be even more profiled and screened. How can we struggle beyond the panic of 9/11 to make these mushrooming surveillance systems more democratically accountable to ethical scrutiny? David Lyon teaches sociology at Queen's University, Ontario, Canada. He is also director of the Surveillance Project and the editor of the new e-journal Surveillance and Society, and author of Surveillance Society Monitoring Everyday Life.
Last night I went to see a thriller, and 144 minutes of Spielberg. And I was fascinated by this thing. The pre-crime unit, the pre-crime department, is intended to work out where murders are going to happen just before they do, just before they do, and then intercept the murderer before the crime can be committed. It's Washington, D.C. in 2046 and the subsequent years. Another interesting thing about this thriller, Minority Report, is that as you walk along the street and as you go through shopping malls, there are interactive ads that recognize you as you pass. And so this is M-commerce taken to one further stage. And so you're greeted. Welcome to the Gap, Mr. Yamamoto. And have you come back for another pair of matching pants? And so on. So these two systems are there in the movie. Now, no connection is made between those two systems in the movie, and that I found interesting because the kind of surveillance that we see around us today is very much surveillance where there is a porousness between different kinds of databases and where one agency can draw upon the databases of another agency. That wasn't really mentioned within the movie, and that's because of the particular way in which they discover who is going to be a murderer. It's interesting that the movie should have come out at just the time when Jose Padilla was arrested because he might have become a dirty bomber. It's also interesting in the light of one of our local police departments in Toronto, which upgraded its equipment last year so that all police cruisers have in-car communication systems and the capacity to access remote databases all over the country, not only police ones but private ones as well, from within their cruisers. And the head of the Information Technology Services for the Toronto Police Department, a guy called Mike Farrer, had this to say about those systems. He said, "The idea is to see patterns of apparently unrelated crimes and to figure out where offenders are likely to be and what they might do next." Very interesting in the light of Minority Report and the pre-crime department. It's frequently in the movies that we get to see certain things that are actually not a million miles from our daily realities. I'm happy to report that because of the events that occurred during that movie, the pre-crime department was closed down in 2054 before it had a chance to go national throughout the United States. Let me start with another statement that may appear provocative to some who are in the surveillance world. And that is that Big Brother is not the problem and privacy is not the solution. I think if we think about those metaphors and those concepts, we can begin to understand the kind of world in which we are today, and I say that advisedly, especially after September the 11th. Big Brother is not the problem. Big Brother was a character invented by George Orwell, a very prescient novelist of 1984, who gave us the leading metaphors that have been used not only in the popular press and media since the Second World War, the book came out in 1948, but also within political science, sociology, policy fields, privacy, data protection departments, all those kinds of things all refer to Big Brother as a leading metaphor. Let me suggest that what has happened in the intervening years between 1984, which was a warning about bureaucratic government and the capacity of a top-down pyramid of control to radically affect the lives of all who were at the bottom of the pyramid. What's happened since then is, in particular, in the 1960s and 1970s, departments were computerized, and what that has led to eventually with the remote networking of computers between different agencies and departments is a far more networked kind of surveillance. It's now nodes within a system that shifts and undulates and moves all the time. It's flows of data that have become crucially important, rather than the omnipresent telescreen from which Big Brother can watch all those hapless citizens of Oceania. However, it's a mistake to think that we have somehow moved from that Big Brother situation to an entirely different situation. What I want to suggest this morning is that although we live in what now might be called a surveillance assemblage, a collection of loosely knit surveillance networks that are everything from the consumer networks through to policing and intelligence networks and many others in between, that although we do live in that kind of situation, the capacity of centralized powers to use the integration capacities of those network systems still means that we have to be very vigilant about surveillance systems in general. We saw that particularly after September the 11th. You'll remember the pictures of Mohammed Atta and his associates that appeared on TV screens and in newspapers the world over. Those images of these people who were collecting groceries from convenience stores, gas from the gas station, going into motels. We saw their records of their telephone calls, their email use, their obtaining airline tickets online, and so on. So what was happening there was that after the event, investigations were able to draw upon that loose-knit, flowing surveillance assemblage, and to bring together discrete bits of data, images, transaction details, and so on, to be used in the investigative process. Now, that might seem a long way from the pre-crime department, and of course, all those claims that are made by the high technology companies following September the 11th, that their new system, whatever it is, FACEIT or many others have been offered, will actually prevent terrorism, is a claim that should be taken with a pinch of salt. There are great problems in moving from that investigation of events that have already occurred through to the notion that you can actually anticipate, preempt, and prevent some undesired event from occurring. So Big Brother isn't exactly the issue any longer. We're not looking at a situation where there are specific people being targeted for specific purposes and singled out for attention. Of course, that happens. But surveillance now affects all of us in the routines of everyday life. It is unavoidable, whether we're on the street, at work, in a cab, on a plane, in an airport. in a school, wherever we are, there are means of keeping tabs on us that have been developed, especially since the 1970s and 80s. So Big Brother is not exactly the problem. Privacy is not exactly the solution. Nothing that I say should be taken to be an argument against using privacy as a mobilizing slogan against certain forms of surveillance when it is felt that those kinds of surveillance are in some way socially negative or intrusive. However, privacy emerges from a particular way of seeing the world that in fact is very close to some of the motifs of surveillance itself. But beyond that, I think we could turn the story round. Frequently, privacy is seen as an antidote to surveillance. It's the thing that you try to protect from surveillance. Let me suggest to you that privacy actually causes surveillance. In the 20th century, lives became far more privatized, far more individualized than they had been in previous centuries. It became increasingly desirable to live relatively anonymous and autonomous lives, largely in urban areas. It was a major shift of the 20th century. Within that situation, privacy, the search for privacy, the quest for privacy, produced a need for some kind of means of knowing that you can trust the person that you're dealing with. And so what happened during the 20th century was a proliferation of all manner of little, what we might call, tokens of trust. So it is that all of you carry with you some little tokens, usually embossed in or embedded in plastic, including perhaps magnetic strips, perhaps even chips, that are intended to show that you are eligible to be here, that you have a right to drive this vehicle, that you can claim this benefit, that you have money that can be withdrawn from an account, and so on and so forth. We all engage in a whole web of relationships with others and with agencies that we have no personal knowledge of, and they have no personal knowledge of us. And so to maintain some sense of our trustworthiness, and that we are eligible, valid, and so on and so forth, we use these tokens of trust. But each of those tokens of trust is also a way of locating ourselves within a network, within a web of surveillance. Seen in that way, of course, the sort of thing that I'm talking about can't be seen in merely negative terms. And I have no intention of arguing that surveillance is somehow a negative, antisocial, or inherently malign process. As you've heard me describe it, it's the way that we have made the world that we live in during the 20th century and now in the 21st century. We see that simply amplified further. So, as I understand it, surveillance is an ambiguous process. It's one that we engage in and we comply with just because we get all kinds of benefits from it. We have convenience, safety, security, comfort, efficiency, all those kinds of things that are highly prized by many are the reasons why we go along with surveillance systems most of the time and in most contexts. But I say it's an ambiguous process. Surveillance always has some kind of benefit attached to it. In the earliest days, for example, if you think of the 18th and early 19th century, when political rights of democratic participation were coming into being, it was necessary to create a list of those who were eligible to vote. And of course, in the first place, that included male property holders only. And then it was to shift to others who were citizens. It was to shift to women as well as men, and so on and so forth. Political rights were expanded, and so the list expanded to include more people. But the very same list that gives you, if you have your name on that list, you have the right to vote, to participate democratically within the system, also yields power to those who hold the list, because it is a means of mediating between the person, in this case, and the nation state. So surveillance has that dual aspect to it. It always has that ambiguity. On the one hand, there are ways in which we have to comply. There are ways in which there is control involved, proscription of our behaviors. On the other hand, there is some protection for us, some care, some guarantee for rights that we may have. So surveillance systems are bound up with a highly ambiguous set of relationships that we have to bear in mind. Now, my argument, of course, is that there are certain junctures when we have to be especially vigilant about surveillance systems because they, for some reason, have shifted more towards the control than the care motif. And I would argue that after September the 11th is precisely one of those junctures when surveillance is being intensified, and because of the kind of surveillance that is being perpetrated, it is likely to lend itself much more to control than to care, despite the fact, of course, that it is being set up after September the 11th precisely with the leading argument that our security will be guaranteed. Again, I am in no way opposed to the notion that after September the 11th, there should be certain measures that are taken by the powers that be to attempt to ensure the security of ordinary citizens. As one who happened to be at 37,000 feet over North American airspace at 9 o'clock on September the 11th, 2001, I am quite confident that there are certain requirements for security that would make at least air travelers feel a lot more comfortable. Big Brother is not the problem. Privacy is not the solution. Privacy covers some kinds of surveillance that I'm talking about, and privacy relates at best to some very important notions about a realm of freedom and of inviolability of the dignity of persons. And I don't want to deny that for a moment. But the kind of surveillance that we see around us today, I argue, should be seen much more in terms of social sorting. Today's surveillance has to do with categorization, classification, using searchable databases that are usually remotely accessible. And it's because we can build up lists of groups of people, clusters of people, who are categorized in particular ways, such that that categorization process continues automatically. Some algorithm is used in order to secure the coding of that categorical group. And that's the way that surveillance works. We are located within a particular group. And of course, we'll be hearing later on today about the issues surrounding categories after September the 11th that may well be highly prejudicial in negative ways towards groups of people who are described as Muslim and Arab in origin. But all kinds of categories include us. That's how you have the categorical seduction of those ads in the movie that I alluded to in the first place. How did they know that this person happened to have bought a pair of pants in the Gap before, and that therefore it might be an idea to see whether they wanted something to match their outfit as the person passed the interactive commercial as they went into the Gap. That is only a technical matter in the sense that it could well be that by 2046 we have exactly those kinds of advertisements that greet us in every shopping mall. May God deliver us from those, but that may well be the kind of world that that we live in. But the point is that we are categorized, we're put into different groups that cluster us in particular ways. And therefore, the issue is not merely an intrusion, a puncturing of our little bubble of personal space, which, of course, is to look at human beings in a very particular way in any case, but rather to do with our classification and our categorization. After September the 11th, let me make a few comments about what has happened since then. What we have seen is a huge thrust of activity to introduce new technological modes of combating what is called terrorism. When I use the word, imagine that there are quotation marks around it. There are huge problems with the definition of terrorism, as you know, from every bit of anti-terrorism legislation that has been introduced since September the 11th. But it's very much a case of technology against terrorism, which in the first place, I think, should raise some questions for us. Why technology against terrorism? Well, simply because during the 20th century, a rapidly increasing implicit faith in the power of technology to solve human problems became evident. The kinds of technologies that have been thrown at terrorism, supposedly, include biometrics in general as modes of identification and pre-identification, along with other sorts of systems. Smart card identifiers for nation states, several of these have had their systems brought forward or have started to talk about the possibilities of national systems of identification using smart cards and usually with some kind of embedded biometric in them. Communications interception, again, continuing the kinds of trends that were perfectly evident before September the 11th, and so on. But it's a classic way of coping with attacks and threats of violence to introduce some new technology. If you look at the history of hijack, first hijack occurred in outside Portland, Oregon in 1971. Someone called Cooper boarded a plane and claimed that he had a bomb on board, got the pilot to land the plane, and demanded a ransom and a parachute when the passengers had been offloaded from the plane. They took off again, and he escaped through the rear door of the plane, which he was able to open from the inside with his parachute and his ransom. After that, what did they do? They fitted what they then called the Cooper vane to the back of all aircraft so that you couldn't open the rear door while it was in flight. Every single hijack and act of aerial violence since then has been met by some other technological solution. And every single one has been overcome by the ingenuity of the next successful hijacker. How do we confront these sorts of things? The movie with which I began is a curious movie in that although it is very much the thriller, I bet you wouldn't get away without any white knuckle moments during the thriller. But despite that, it still has time for some very curious, classic conversations about fate and destiny, about what has been foreordained and how far there are choices within the world of, pre-crime in this case. And it seems to me that the movie is salutary in that sense as well, because it points to certain fundamental issues. It raises questions again about, well, what is human after all? And it seems to me that it doesn't hurt to, from time to time, raise those questions again, particularly when the systems that affect our lives from day to day, that constrain our life chances or constrain our choices, are ones that are based on abstract data that is taken away from embodied social persons. And so it seems to me that some kind of ethical scrutiny, some kind of ethical critique is required. And the sources of those should be publicly debated and discussed. And there are many good sources for those kinds of ethical critique that begin with embodied social persons who really have faces after all, are ones that I think are frequently discounted. And yet, it is as big a mistake to discount some of the sources on which I base my work as it is to make claims, for example, that everyone who has an Islamic background is an enthusiast for violent jihad. Simply not the case. But neither is it the case when we think about the kinds of Jewish and Christian sources for philosophies of the person that relate to real, embodied, flesh and blood, social relationship, faced people. It's very easy to write them off. There are plenty of arguments, and we see them frequently, about white Christian Australia, for example. And yet if you read your own historian, Henry Reynolds, as I have, you'll discover that those who were in the forefront of arguments against the policies of the Stolen Generation, of removing, of forcible removal of Aboriginal persons, were frequently members of that white Christian clergy. And they had certain views of persons that are very close to the ones that I'm arguing from today. And those can be shared with a wide range of people. You may want to accuse me of essentialism or something, and just fine by me. But it does seem to me that recalling the flesh and blood embodied person with a face in a set of social relationships is a great place to start an ethical critique of abstract systems that move further and further away from the human-oriented and the labor-intensive forms of surveillance systems themselves. And of course, from that ethical critique comes the necessity for political engagement. As I say, the new terrain in the 21st century for political activity is increasingly around information. And those, however fine your ethical principles and the scrutiny with which we apply those two contemporary forms of surveillance as social sorting, will mean very little. So many privacy policies and laws around the world are based upon placing the responsibility back on the individual person. It is my responsibility or your responsibility, A, to discover that our privacy has been violated, and then to know what are the recourses, to what we can apply and to whom we can find some, from whom we can find some support to overcome that situation. My argument would be to turn the thing around altogether and to introduce much stronger arguments that the onus should be on those who process personal data to show that they are accountable and transparent. That is the way around that it ought to be. Given the amount of power that is appropriated by those who are in charge of social sorting, it seems to me that the onus should be on them to be accountable. So whether it's closed circuit television systems, smart cards as identifiers, irises and retinas as biometrics, whatever it is, it seems to me we need to turn the question around, ask questions of accountability first, before we ask questions about my personal privacy and how I go about defending it. There's some of the big picture then. Big Brother is not the problem, privacy is not the solution. September the 11th has intensified forms of surveillance around the world, and that intensification will continue so long as political panic regimes are still in operation and publics whose fears have been amplified by mass media treatments of September the 11th are still anxious and worried, such that they are cheerfully complicit with the development of new surveillance systems. There is a struggle that ought to be joined. Thanks.
David, a lot of the dialogue about introducing systems like this or intensifying them come from a point of view of fighting crime. That seems to be a very convenient argument to use. For a lot of the, I think the majority of the population, they probably think that I'm not going to do anything wrong, it's there to protect me, it's going to be a good thing. I've got a slightly different version of it, which is I'm probably a little bit more of the opinion of what if I actually want to do something right? If you have, say, a social agenda to follow, there's always going to be some vested interest that you will be coming up against. Maybe, for instance, you've got aspirations for, I don't know, human rights or mining abuses or whatever. There's always going to be a large opposition to it. I'm very interested about either the individual or that can affect social change from a sort of public relations point of view.
Yeah, a couple of thoughts on that. Sure, the way in which we think about surveillance systems frequently does refer to crime prevention systems, about having done nothing wrong, therefore having nothing to fear, is one of the most vacuous phrases that one can hear if we think about surveillance as social sorting. We are already in categories of suspicion, categories of seduction, as I think of them in the consumer sphere. One of the biggest problems, it seems to me, is that we've allowed the debate to become individualized. I've done nothing wrong, I've got nothing to fear. If you've done nothing wrong, it means that the surveillance system is still just as significant for you. And you raise a question about how that can be made clear in the more mundane realm of everyday transactions. There's a number of consumer groups and those kinds of organizations that have actually started to raise issues about what happens to personal data, not nearly enough, given the size of the, what I think of as the new terrain of social and political struggle around information. But there is at least at the academic level some studies that show how choices, consumer choices, have long-term effects on life chances. Look at the work, for example, of Steve Graham, who with Simon Marvin is the author of a couple of books. One is, the newest one is called Splintered Urbanism, or Splintering Urbanism. And in there, they show how those ordinary little choices that we make as consumers, once recorded and included in market research databases and direct marketing databases, not only mean that we then get advertising that comes to us because of the choices that we have made and the preferences that we've demonstrated, but also that others involved in urban planning, in the determination of where facilities are likely to be located within a city, also bear in mind those kinds of choices. So that in the longer term and in the larger geographical space, how you have behaved as a consumer does have long-term implications for your life chances in the area where you live and work. So there are at least reliable studies that are being made about how those kinds of consumer surveillance do have an effect on people's life chances and choices. And it's at that level, based on good evidence, that we need to begin the what I think of as the ethical scrutiny and the political participation in the process.
I understand that you're saying that the onus should be on the companies that collect our information and so on. And I understand also that we are, you know, seduced or enticed by various means to give a lot of that information over. I've recently given Telstra my driver's license number because they had my birthday wrong in their database, and it gives a second backup means of identifying me, and they asked my permission to take that number and I gave it to them. Stupid or whatever. What I'm wondering, apart from governmental legislation that says that it is the onus of the company to divulge that information when required, in combination with Freedom of Information Acts, in combination with whatever other enticements and enforcements you want to make on those companies, how do we, given the lack of control that we have in this society, get those companies, for instance the tenant database that's mentioned in the Reader, to give us that information when we ask for it? How do we track who has what information and where and how they're using it?
It's a great question. I don't know the answer straightforwardly, but it underlines again, it underscores what I was trying to say about the use of personal data being a new terrain of social struggle. It's precisely that we need to raise at every level. The previous question too asked about the range and levels of databases in which personal data is stored and processed. And clearly they are very, very different. They have certain things in common. The fact that they use searchable databases is one of those. But we are talking about many different levels, and that's why it seems to me the struggle needs to take place at many different levels, at the level of community groups and community workers in schools and universities. There's an educational aspect to it. There is a media aspect to it. It seems to me that it all depends on what sort of organization that we're talking about. If it's something like Telstra, where there are already supposedly means of answering back, and consumer rights organizations that can attempt to put pressure on the organization to make them more transparent, then that may be the way to go there. It may be far more difficult with regard to police departments, and of course there's a high degree of secrecy in some departments and organizations that you're actually going to have to do very serious battle in order to get those to increase the level of transparency of the organization. But as I said, unless we can engage the struggle at whatever level is appropriate, then the likelihood is that in the present circumstances that the motifs of proscription and control are likely to become stronger.
David, you spoke of the ambiguity of surveillance, and one of the key sites that we would see that being played out on at a sort of superstructural level is between, you know, the neoliberal state and the corporation. And my question really follows on from the previous one, in wishing to press you more on the shift in relations that we see as the state indeed becomes increasingly, a replica or sort of articulated with corporations, and in so doing, the category of the citizen subject is undermined and made more mythical. And what you seem to be arguing for then is an advocacy of an argument which is along the lines of consumer sovereignty, because it seems terribly idealistic, I think, to be asking for more transparency from these processing agencies who, after all, are engaged in the property of maintaining the security of intellectual property regimes. So I aside from sort of consumer lobby groups, I don't see a sort of terribly compelling political philosophy that wishes to advocate the consumer subject as the key political subject in this.
Yeah, I'm not really arguing for a shift towards, the sovereign consumer at all. My argument is rather that there are numerous levels on which this debate has to be mounted and at which the struggle has to be joined. So it seems to me that consumer groups are just one aspect of the debate, and I'm not arguing that that is somehow a replacement for already existing kinds of political involvement, and certainly not the only one either. I wish I knew the answers to this. I think we're on very new terrain, and we're engaging a conversation that we haven't fully understood. There are already existing struggles around personal data that have frequently been carried out very ably by certain groups that are concerned about personal privacy and so on and so forth, and those, I think, ought to be built upon rather than rejected. There are others that come from the point of view of consumer groups. There are others that emerge from within what might be called the professional organizations. And one does see a number of organizations within computing and information science, for example, computer professionals, who have a very clear cutting edge of ethical responsibility. And you can find those on the internet, and that's particularly where they are active. So that's another level. That's not consumer, the sovereign consumer at work, or even consumer groups working with others. That's trying to look at the way in which coding is done, the way in which these algorithmic systems are set up in the first place, and to raise the level of ethical debate about what's appropriate and how those kinds of processes can be made more transparent. So it does seem to me that the thing can occur on a number of different levels, and we do see some green shoots of hope at each of the levels that I've mentioned. I haven't mentioned a level of political debate where there isn't some sign out there of activity that it seems to me should give us some grounds for thinking that there is a chance for political opposition to what I was describing.
David, do you think that information and information systems are inherently rational, and how does that intersect with what I think are your really refreshing ideas about ethics and trust and care?
Can you just say what you mean by rational?
Well, I see opportunities for hope and ethics and trust and that in the fact that the way that information is collected and the databases and the systems that it's in are limited by their algorithmic mm-hmm. and rational...
Yeah, okay. Well, yeah. Again, thanks for the question. These are really good questions. You give a talk that is very broadly based, and of course you end up with very broadly based questions. Are they rational? I think the key point is that they embody a particular kind of rationality, and it's a kind of rationality that I was trying to describe when I said that they are based on fragments of data that are abstracted from human bodies and human personal activities, and sometimes from group data as well. And they're abstracted and to be combined and recombined in different forms such that there are other entities out there that then have an effect on the actual everyday flesh and blood relational lives of ordinary people. And that's been discussed for a number of years. Roger Clark, who's speaking later on this morning, wrote years ago about the digital persona, and others have talked about data doubles and digital phantoms and so on and so forth. It's all the same kind of idea, that there is an entity out there that is created by this process of abstraction that nonetheless, however little we would recognize our data double, that data double still has crucial effects on our life chances. It, in a sense, from our point of view, might be quite unrecognizable and wrong, but it still has an effect on our lives. So from that point of view, that's why I think the critique should start from where we are and to try to demand responses that are going to be fostering trust, social relationships, and so on and so forth. Living again in a world as if our faces mattered to each other as the means of recognition and acceptance and eligibility and so on and so forth. And it's not beyond the realm of the very world in which we live, namely one that is suffused with information systems, to recreate those systems, to code those systems in a way that is much more in line with the desires and hopes and fears of ordinary people in everyday life than the way that they are designed at the moment, which has much more to do with the dreams of computer scientists of fully integrated systems, with the dreams of police departments of crime prevention before it occurs, and so on and so forth. That's a kind of technological utopia to them, nightmare to most of us, and it's one that we need to confront.
Thanks, David.
You're listening to David Lyon speaking on Our Surveillance Society, a keynote address to City-State 2002 held at Horty Hall in Melbourne. David Lyon teaches sociology at Queen's University, Ontario, Canada. He is also director of the Surveillance Project and the editor of the new e-journal Surveillance and Society, and also author of Surveillance Society, Monitoring Everyday Life. Dean Wilson is a research fellow in the Department of Criminology at the University of Melbourne. He is currently completing the first major study of town centre closed-circuit television systems in Australia.
Thank you. I just wanted to outline today a little bit of a study that I'm undertaking. I'm concerned specifically with town centre closed-circuit television. Just to make a definition on that, as opposed to sort of the closed-circuit television on public transport systems and private systems and casinos, what I mean by town centre closed-circuit television is the systems around Australia that are run by local governments, usually in close partnership with the police. There's currently 34 of these systems in Australia. The first one appeared in 1991 in Perth, where they established 26 cameras, and they now have a 106 camera system that operates through both public and semi-public spaces in the city of Perth. They've expanded considerably. In 1996, there were only 12 of these systems, and as I mentioned, now the number is up to 34. They can range anything from small two-camera systems in small towns such as Lithgow in New South Wales, where the systems only record, through to the major systems like Perth, where there's three operators, sitting there actively monitoring the cameras 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So there's quite a variation in the systems. And I just sort of mention some of the important points about these systems. One is that they've grown in Australia mainly through local government initiative, and there's been no sort of coordination of how they've grown. So it's been a very ad hoc growth. There's also been great variation in the reasons why they've been established. While broadly the aim of these systems is to prevent crime, the sort of detailed aims have been quite varying. Some systems have been established to deal with specific problems, such as drug dealing, which was the case with the Cabramatta system. Other systems are to deal more specifically with problems such as alcohol-related violence, which is more the case with the Gold Coast system. How do these systems get established? Well, primarily from my own research, which is a Criminology Research Council project looking at the systems around Australia, the general pattern tends to be that they've resulted from initiatives from the business communities of various towns and cities. Often, too, they've resulted from local councillors who've been strongly attracted to these systems because they're very popular with ratepayers and they tend to get votes, primarily because they have a powerful symbolic value. To have cameras in any town shows that local government is doing something about problems of order. And so that's been a powerful incentive. But a third factor that's quite significant too that needs to be kept in mind is that there's a powerful drive from the security industry to promote such systems, and they've been very much a driving force in many towns in establishing these systems. That is, security consultants will come in, advise that CCTV can be established to deal with specific problems, and quite often security consultants are acting as agents for certain manufacturers of technology, so they will suggest a particular kind of system that can be established somewhere, usually one that happens to be a close associate of theirs. Mostly the cameras are operated and monitored by private security firms, although there are some cases in Australia where they're monitored by the police, although that's only in two locations. Another option too is that in Tasmania they're actually monitored by Neighbourhood Watch volunteers, so there are some different... And that does raise a few issues that you might want to talk about later. Another important point about the systems is that they're currently subject to no legal regulation at all, unlike in the UK, where they're subject to the oversight of the Data Protection Commissioner. In Australia, they're subject to no state or federal law. So at the moment, any codes of practice or memorandums of understanding are entirely voluntary. Any sort of disclosure is entirely voluntary. The complaints processes in relation to the systems are generally fairly unclear as well. Of course, you can ring up your local council and complain about the systems, but other than that, there's no actual mechanism in place whereby a private individual can make a complaint about how the system is operating. It's also very difficult for private individuals to access videotape footage. The systems are established to allow police access to footage. So mechanisms for private individuals accessing footage are usually very unclear indeed, although in some cases it is possible, usually for solicitors, to access footage if it's related to a pending court case. But if a private individual was to go forward and say that they simply wanted to see themselves walking up Bourke Street at 12:45 yesterday, it would be highly unlikely that you would get access to any tape. And that sort of leads me on to another point about these systems, is that we have very little published information about them currently. There's some move towards publishing information. The City of Sydney now publishes its codes of practice, which are available as a public document. There's no evaluation of any system currently available on the public record. I noticed David Lyon talked earlier about a certain culture of secrecy in some organisations. I'd have to say from my own visits to these systems around Australia, although I've been allowed reasonable access to most systems, there is certainly a culture of secrecy around some, though not all, of the CCTV systems in Australia. That is that there's some concern, particularly with media, how the media will react to the systems. There's a great sensitivity to releasing material to the media. around the systems, mainly from some towns that have actually received some negative press. Ipswich released some footage to, I think, one of the TV channels and has been very upset that that footage has been replayed again and again whenever a media item about CCTV appears. The footage actually showed a street brawl, and the concern with Ipswich is the negative spin that that gives to the city, and that it implies that it's a place where there's a continuing street brawl going on. So they're not very happy about that at all, and most actually have a policy of releasing no footage at all from the camera systems, and there's good and bad things about that. From what one of the major questions asked about these systems is, of course, do they actually do what they're supposed to do, which is, do they reduce crime? Now, there's been some privacy advocates, particularly Simon Davis of Privacy International, who've tended to argue that CCTV systems do not work. That is a claim heard quite frequently. I think that claim is a little overstated, because from the research that I've seen and from the anecdotal reports, there is actually some evidence that CCTV does reduce crime. So the argument that it doesn't reduce crime should be treated with some caution if people are attempting to make it. It does reduce certain sorts of offences in certain places. The other thing it does do is it does displace offending to other areas, particularly in relation to drug dealing. It will displace it. And while some people may see that as a bad thing, from the police and system managers that I've interviewed, they're actually quite often very happy with displacement, particularly if it's displacing things away from an area that's a major shopping precinct and into an area where less people are circulating. So displacement is not automatically seen as a bad thing, and there is no doubt that CCTV cameras continually trained on an area will displace some forms of offending. Another point often made by privacy advocates too is that CCTV systems are extremely expensive, and I think this is another thing that needs to be treated with some caution, because the costs of installing CCTV in town centres has fallen dramatically in the past 5 years and is likely to continue falling. In Newcastle, for example, in 1996, they had a quote for installing CCTV in the city that was $1.2 million to install cameras there. They're currently installing it at a cost of $200,000, which gives some indication of how far the costs are falling. And I'll just sort of wrap it up a bit by saying talking about some of the trends that CCTV town centre systems are likely to take, I think, in the next 5 years. This is one. I think systems are going to continue to expand. From what I've seen, every system that's been installed in Australia has subsequently grown. There's no instance of a system being decommissioned in Australia. The other thing is that they will continue to expand, and they will expand mostly to outer suburban shopping centre locations, and they will expand into regional centres because they're already established in capital centres around Australia. And the prices will continue to drop, and the equipment will get smaller and more difficult to notice. They won't be the large pan and tilt cameras that some people have in their mind when they think of CCTV. They're now tiny domes, and they're becoming more and more miniaturised. There's a large trend towards system integration, that is the linking of town centre CCTV systems with public transport systems and also with some private systems such as casino systems. Technologically, that's quite possible now, and it's likely that that will occur to a greater extent in the future. And I know some people are going to be talking a bit more about facial recognition technology today, and there's already been some mention of that. Facial recognition systems have already been presented by the security industry to several capital cities in Australia, and my assumption would be that within the next 5 years there will be a trial of facial recognition technology in an Australian capital city system. And I'll wrap it up there, but I'll just say one last thing, that we might consider whether Australia needs something along the lines of the English Data Protection Act, where systems are centrally registered and are subject to a legally enforceable code of practice. It's unlikely that you're actually going to turn the clock back on CCTV town centre systems now. given that they're already so well established, but something like that at least provides some protection against their current expansion. So, thanks.
That was Dean Wilson at City State 2002 talking about closed circuit television.